And now, it's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
As soon as you are able.
Here at Quark's, customer satisfaction is our primary concern.
I'd say we just found our way into a wormhole.
I'm Kira Norris.
Lieutenant Commander Worf, reporting for duty, sir.
You're the best crew any captain ever had. This may be the last time we're all together.
This will shortly become a leading center of commerce and of scientific exploration. For Starfleet, one of our most important posts.
It is quite simply, Commander. The journey you have always been destined to take.
Sensors are not functioning.
You've lost all contact with the space station.
The hell is happening out there?
Shields up. Damage report.
Battle stations.
I'm Captain Benjamin Sisko. Welcome to Deep Space Nine.
Listen to the prophets. A Deep Space Nine Two True Freaks presentation with Sean Engel. And Andrew Layla.
And now with 100% more Paul Spataro.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to episode 6 of... Is it 6?
Yes.
Is it?
Yeah. I can understand how it might be difficult with you counting that far with your shoes on and you fly up, but it is number 6.
Oh, thank you. Episode number 6 of Listen to the Prophets.
Is it because last time I thought it was number 4 because the first one we did was Emissary, then... I don't care.
You know what, hold on. Let's start that all over again. Hello, everybody, and welcome to an unnumbered episode of Listen to the Prophets.
And just for the record, it is episode number 5. So for once in his life, Sean was right.
I'm Paul Spataro, and I'm here with my two space station-dwelling cohorts, Mr. Sean Engel.
Hey.
And Mr. Andrew Leyland.
Hello.
And we are here today to discuss what is at least billed as episode number 6 of Star Trek Deep Space Nine, Captive Pursuit. But before we get into that, anybody got any Star Trek stuff to talk about?
No, not this time.
Because we've done so much in the past 2 weeks.
That's true. Well, the only other thing I have of note right now, and it's unfortunately something I did not witness but would have been extremely cool, is at New York Comic Con, apparently they had a TNG reunion hosted by William Shatner.
Ooh. Wow.
And that I think, you know, I would imagine, I think they did it on Saturday evening. And I think it would have been one of these things where if you're not online by noon on Saturday, you're not getting in. So basically, you would have to dedicate your day to attending that probably 1 hour panel.
No, I don't think I'd bother, to be honest.
Yeah, I would love
to
see
it. I'm sure it was great, but yeah.
I would love to see it, but I couldn't imagine just sitting on, you know, having New York Comic Con going on around me, but I have to sit in this one spot waiting. It's almost like the definition of torture. So I don't think I would do that, but I would love to see a video of it. I would imagine there's something circulating.
Yeah, there's got to be something online where someone sat in there and taped it, or I wouldn't doubt, does New York Comic Con release videos of some of the panels that go on there? Do you know anything, if they do anything like that?
Not that I've ever seen. I've only seen releases of stuff, you know, by individuals. Never anything that was sanctioned by the people who run the con. And I, you know, as we discussed on Back to the Bins, which will air sometime, I don't know how, I don't think it's going to work in conjunction with this in any way, but I shouldn't be giving them quite so much airtime considering they denied my press pass request this year.
Bastards.
Yeah. only a couple.
The low pay.
The low pay. You mean the no pay. Only a couple of casting notes on this one, far more than last time though. Scott McDonald, who plays Tosk, this was his first appearance in anything ever, and in addition to cropping up in pretty much every major TV show of the past 10 years, if you scroll through his IMDb, you'll see he was in Without a Trace and NCIS, SNER and Dexter and Boston Legal, but as far as we're concerned, he will crop up in every single Star Trek show from this point forward. And he will also crop up again in Deep Space Nine as a member of the Jem'Hadar later on in, I think it's season 4 or season 5, I don't remember which episode he comes back, but he does. Gerrit Graham, who played the Hunter, almost unrecognisable under the makeup that he's working, was in everything, pretty much. He was in Child's Play. He was in episodes of The A-Team, but he's probably best known for what we're talking about, for being in an episode of Star Trek Voyager, one of the best they ever did, where he plays another member of the Q Continuum, and the episode is all about the right to die and assisted suicide. Oh. That's a great episode of Star Trek Voyager. So, but you'll probably know Gerrit Graham from everything. He's in The New Adventures of Superman, Lois and Clark, Babylon 5, everything that has ever been on television has probably featured Gerrit Graham, but he was in Parker Lewis Can't Lose as well, if anyone remembers that show that isn't me.
That was a takeoff on Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Yeah, with Corin Nemec in it before he went on to be in Stargate.
Yep.
My thing for him was he was on the miniseries for The Stand.
Right.
He was the kind of downtrodden kid in that. Yeah, I remember that.
That's all I got.
Again, Andy proves his encyclopedic knowledge, and that's one of the many, many reasons why he is the anchor on this show.
I'm sorry, did you say anchor?
Anchor. Oh, you anchor. Hold us all steady, steady and keep us, keep us grounded.
Not that you weigh us down in any way and keep us from moving. No, that's not
I thought you just called me a wanker, which would be perfectly acceptable.
Maybe later, after we go to bed.
After you two have been in bed together, yeah.
Uh-oh. There was one...
I love Paul's discomfort whenever we mention that.
If you only knew
it's just,
how
it's
early...
just going to make me avoid the whole state of Oklahoma. That's all.
Oh!
It's not
Oklahoma. Oklahoma.
It's not Oklahoma you have to worry about. It's Arkansas. The only other...
I apologize to all listeners from Arkansas. Please email Sean Engel at...
Just one of the guys podcast at gmail.com. All your hate mail goes there. The only other person that I saw, a character actor that showed up this, was daughter of Tony Curtis and Janet Leigh. The character Kelly Curtis, who's also the sister of Jamie Leigh Curtis, played Miss Sodra, the Dabu girl, the opening part of the... So there was the only other...
The Dabu girl, who is so stupid, she doesn't actually read that her contract has a clause in it that says that Quark can sleep with you at any time.
Okay, think about it, Andy. This is a Ferengi contract. It is probably about the size... It probably makes the Star Trek companion, the Star Trek Deep Space Nine companion, look like a pamphlet. So I guarantee that she just said, oh, I just have
and she
to sign
needed
here.
The work.
Well, don't they all?
Right, we might as well get into our description of this episode since we're already discussing it.
Let's do it.
A wanted predator from the other side threatens the space station.
Show me where the weapons are stored.
Now the crew finds themselves battling the unknown on the next Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
This episode was aired on January 31st, 1993. It's directed by Corey Allen, and it is written by Jill Sherman Donner and Michael Pillar. My synopsis comes from StarTrek.com. Thank you very much for doing it so I don't have to. While listening to a complaint about Quark's lascivious behavior from a Dabo girl, Sisko is alerted that an alien vessel is coming through the wormhole. The vessel contains a reptilian being named Tosk, who reluctantly agrees to allow O'Brien to tow in his destroyed ship. O'Brien then boards Tosk's ship to inspect its systems and introduce himself. Though suspicious of O'Brien's kindness, Tosk follows him onto the promenade and is fascinated by all that he sees. After talking a while, O'Brien learns that Tosk is very different from human beings. He requires very little sleep, food, and has no sense of humor. His behavior seems odd to O'Brien, and he alerts Sisko to keep an eye on him. After talking more with Tosk while repairing his ship, O'Brien tells the rest of the officers that he thinks Tosk is in danger. Then Odo discovers Tosk altering a junction box in a remote corridor and apprehends him. Much to Sisko's frustration, Tosk does not respond to questioning, and O'Brien feels partially to blame for the mess because he introduced Tosk to the station. Later, a new ship with emission patterns that match those of Tosk's ship arrives at Deep Space Nine, and three aliens beam aboard without invitation. Those beings are hostile, and a phaser battle ensues as they are able to enter Odo's security office and capture Tosk. The lead alien then informs Sisko that he is a hunter, and Tosk is his prey. Sisko tells the hunter that his type of blood sport is no longer practiced at this station. Against his better judgment, but in accordance with Starfleet's prime directive, Sisko agrees to release Tosk into the hunter's custody. Then Kira, sensitive to O'Brien's feelings of despair and his new friend, suggests that Tosk request asylum, thus allowing him to be protected by the Federation. Alas, Tosk refuses to go against his culture and does not ask for asylum. However, O'Brien, claiming to have orders from Sisko, intervenes when the hunter tries to take Tosk off the station. O'Brien programs a security checkpoint to debilitate the hunter as they pass through it, and he grabs Tosk and leads him to a narrow escape. Sisko reprimands O'Brien for taking matters into his own hands, yet it is obvious that Sisko thought he did the right thing. Killing, they agree, simply for the sake of sport, should not be allowed in any star system. Now, I remember this episode. We were talking on last week's show about how I think we were talking about it. I don't know if we were talking about it in the show or if it was just general conversation. We were talking about how I joined Deep Space Nine during its fifth season and then went back and watched the earlier episodes. And I recall going back and looking at TV.com, and they rate every episode that's on there on a scale of 1 to 10. And I checked out the first season episodes, and I think this may have been the highest rated episode as I watched it. And I remember the first time watching it, based on that, I was a little disappointed that it didn't quite live up to what I had thought at the time. However, with hindsight and watching it again, I think it's a pretty solid episode overall. It's more of a character piece than it is any kind of world building. And it's really an O'Brien episode, and I've complained a little bit about how they focused on O'Brien so much early on, thinking he was going to be a key player based on his coming over from TNG, and that realistically, as it went on, he just kind of faded back into the ensemble. But I think this is a very good O'Brien episode. And I think the story, the Predator-like story, is also very well done. And the real character moments, I think, come from the fact that Tosk just doesn't really understand the culture here. And I get a vibe not unlike Drax in the recent Guardians of the Galaxy movie from him.
I definitely get a vibe. I don't know if you remember the Jeff Bridges movie Starman, especially a lot of the aspects of how Tosk carried himself and how he, you know, the sort of moves that he made that were very bird-like, him looking around. It definitely gave me that sort of feel of the alien character that Jeff Bridges played in that movie, relating this character. But yeah, I like this episode. It's an interesting episode. It's the first time we'll see some other race from the Gamma Quadrant come to Deep Space Nine. It's obviously an allegory for the whole idea of hunting and the sort of blood sport and how the Federation has sort of advanced beyond that. But it's also a great character piece to show how the Federation deals with first contact in a frontier manner. How do we maintain the ideals of the Federation with first contact protocols versus taking care of a person who's being hunted, essentially?
I loved this one. I really did enjoy this episode. I think it works very, very well as a character piece for Chief O'Brien, but also, by extension, for Sisko as well, who chews him out for what he's done but secretly encourages what he's done, with the ending where they make it quite plain that Sisko could have caught him but didn't and let him go because they agreed with what O'Brien was doing. I'm a sucker for the most dangerous game anyway. Any time that they do that plot in anything. Most famously for me, there was an episode of The Incredible Hulk called The Snow with Bradford Dillman in it, where they do the same thing. This guy captures David Banner to use him for hunting, like he's Kraven the Hunter, and he ends up getting the Hulk, which just thrills him no end when he realizes what David can become. So anytime anyone wants to do the most dangerous game, I'm all for, because I think it's brilliant. I did enjoy this. I love Scott McDonald's performance as Tosk, although, like, we're never quite sure, is Tosk his race? Is Tosk his name? He's just referred to as Tosk throughout the entire episode. Garrett Graham is a brilliant actor who's a little bit wasted in this. But like I said, he will get to strut his stuff in the Star Trek Voyager episode at some point in the future. I thought it was very well written. Jill Sherman Donner also comes from The Incredible Hulk. She wrote a number of episodes of that show. Michael Piller is obviously the guy who created Deep Space Nine. So if anyone's going to know character drama and what all these people would act like, it's going to be him. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I thought this was really good. The makeup in this one is fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
We get a really good phase of battle sequence in the middle. Great show. Really enjoyed it.
Yeah, the makeup. So go ahead, Paul.
I was going to say, I have a little bit of a problem. I understand totally what you're saying, Andy, about Sisko kind of, you know, giving O'Brien the wink as far as what he did. But I have a little bit of a problem with the whole thing. Like, I think it might have seemed a little bit more realistic to me if before it happened, Sisko had told him, you know, these are our orders from Starfleet, and kind of winkingly let him know, you know, and I'm following the rules, but you don't have to listen to what I'm saying, kind of thing, as opposed to O'Brien taking it on himself to do it, and then Sisko saying, yeah, that's okay with me. Because now we're having multiple instances on the show where people are openly defying the rules that Sisko is setting forth. It's going to create mayhem if that's allowed.
Yes. I felt in this one it kind of worked, because we're still early enough in the show that everyone is still trying to figure out how this is all going to work on Deep Space Nine.
But I think that's part of the problem, is if it was later in the show, now they understand each other and they know where each other are, and we've established Sisko as the authority figure. In this instance, he hasn't had time to really truly set his authority yet, and they're already defying him, and he's saying, yeah, that's all right.
I didn't see this as O'Brien defying Sisko, more that he didn't feel this was the right thing to do. And there is that scene in the middle of the show where Quark's talking at him, and he basically comes to the rather simplistic conclusion, okay, change the rules, which he doesn't actually do. He breaks the rules. He disobeys his orders, essentially, even though he's not been given any in this particular instance. Sisko actually says that, I've not given O'Brien any orders. So what O'Brien's doing here is following his conscience. He's done that before on Next Generation. He didn't flat out disobey Picard in The Wounded, but he did something that may not necessarily have been within the remit of what his job description was. Now, I got from this one that essentially what O'Brien did was he forced Sisko's hand. Sisko probably would have just let Garrett Graham's character take Tosk away, and that would have been the end of it. He wouldn't have liked it, but he would have followed orders. As this stands, O'Brien did what O'Brien did. Sisko's given him a dressing down, but as far as Starfleet knows, he doesn't do anything wrong. My interpretation of this was Sisko's report would be that by the rules of the culture that we encountered, we basically just let them go about their business, which you can argue is the letter of the law with the Prime Directive. I'm not arguing with you that what O'Brien did breaks chain of command with Sisko, but Sisko can then not even mention that O'Brien did that in his report to Starfleet. Do you see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. I understand, and I'm just, like I said, I'm just thinking it from overall. As one episode, I think that scene is fine. But from a world-building point of view, and this really isn't a world-building episode, but from just a situation where Sisko is still relatively new at this station, and he's still establishing where he stands, I think it would have just been a little better if, like I said, if he had given him that winking approval before he did it. It sort just of, would have seemed, it would have left him more in a position of authority.
Sort of akin to, go ahead, Andy.
No, all I was going to say from that is at this point, Sisko doesn't know O'Brien well enough to do that with him.
So then O'Brien doesn't know Sisko well enough to defy him. That's what I'm saying.
Exactly. But O'Brien was willing to defy him because his conscience was telling him to defy him. And see, it does. It's one of those that this wouldn't happen in real life. You wouldn't have somebody flagrantly disregard orders like O'Brien does here. In real life, I don't think they'd be court-martialed. Because Starfleet, I don't really care what Gene Roddenberry says, Starfleet is military.
Oh, absolutely.
And certainly on Deep Space Nine, it's a military organization. I think he's handled this internally in a way that has proven to the people who are serving under him that he is a captain that can be trusted. That, yes, if you do something wrong, you're going to chew him out. And I think him chewing O'Brien out was what you're saying. It was his disappointment that O'Brien had argued this with him and gone against him. Whereas maybe if he'd approached him with it, he would have backed him up and done like you said, give him the wink, said something to him that, no, you can't do that, and winked at him. And then said, right, you know what I've just said to you. Whereas I think what this is showing, it's certainly showing Kira as well, that Sisko is not somebody who will blindly follow orders if he doesn't think those orders are right.
Well, in some way, I kind of see that if he would have done that, if O'Brien would have come to Sisko and approached him in that way, he would have done something similar to what he did with Julian Bashir in the episode where in the episode with Garrick, where he told, you know, Bashir, maybe you need to go and get fitted for a new suit. Sisko knows what's going on. He knows that there's that they can't use protocol. They can't use the rules to get around the rules to get this done. So they kind of have to sort of go around it. And if I agree, if he would have approached him prior to actually defying him, there wouldn't be this problem with between Sisko and O'Brien.
But then Sisko's disobeying orders.
Well, he's just looking the other way. Go ahead.
I'm more comfortable with the idea of Sisko disobeying orders and then presenting it to Starfleet in a way where they have to say, all right, he did what he needed to do or something. You know, so maybe not present, you know, not making it so obvious that he presented orders in, or that he disobeyed orders in his report, than I am with O'Brien taking it on himself to disobey orders and then just dealing with the fallout from Sisko.
Right. Okay. I just think
it could have been written a little better for just that one point. Otherwise, I'm very happy with this episode.
Mm-hmm.
See, I think this follows more the original series idea that Captain Kirk is out there on his own. He can't go running to Starfleet with every decision. And I think this episode is kind of similarly setting that situation up with Sisko. Sisko has a wide latitude to get done what needs to be done here. He's out on his own. He's in an unfamiliar part of space, on an unfamiliar space station, dealing with a potentially explosive political situation. I don't think Starfleet needs to know about this. And I don't think he told them about it.
And I think if they would have approached it in that way, that Sisko would have been essentially doing the whole Kirk thing. He would have had to make this decision on his own, and it would have worked out better. I think you hit the nail on the head, Andy. This is the Kirk type moment where he's not, where following the rules doesn't necessarily mean doing the right thing.
And therefore, if he had been in on the decision making for O'Brien to set Tosk free, that would have been much more palatable for me.
But isn't that a superior officer telling a subordinate to disobey orders?
No. I wouldn't have liked that at all. What I would have liked is if O'Brien came to Sisko and expressed his unhappiness with the Starfleet resolution of this, and Sisko maybe said something to the effect of, well, what are you suggesting, Chief, that we do blah, 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 and then kind of wink at him. You know, Starfleet wouldn't like that. And then, you know, basically lets him know that he's approving him doing it.
While still disapproving, quote unquote, officially.
Yeah, he's never saying, go ahead and do it, but he's letting him know, if you do this, I'm going to back you up and I'm not going to let you get in trouble for it. And then he sweeps it under the rug with Starfleet so that they don't know about it. But as it stands, he's got a crew now who he's basically letting them know, you know, yes, I want you to do what's right, even if it defies what I say. And from a moral point of view, that's fine. But from a military view point of view, not so much.
It's a very ambiguous Prime Directive episode then, isn't it? If the Prime Directive's main mandate is you cause no harm, you do not interfere. By Sisko's interpretation of the Prime Directive at the end of this episode, they let Tosk be taken into captivity. O'Brien's definition of the Prime Directive is to put everything back as it was before Deep Space Nine got involved. And you can argue both of them work.
Yeah, well, I think that's kind of the ephemera of the Prime Directive, that it's never been, or has it ever been specifically set out exactly what the Prime Directive is supposed to do? Because it seems that, you know, the interpretation of what exactly the Prime Directive is supposed to do, whether it's just completely hands-off any civilization, or we can't allow harm to happen. So
yeah, I don't think the Prime Directive specifies harm. I think they're not supposed to interfere with the advancement of outside cultures.
So if this culture is going to essentially start a war with itself and destroy itself, then they have to allow that, which is, which one would think would be morally wrong. But
yeah. And I think by its very nature, the Prime Directive is impossible to keep, because if you're out there trying to explore new civilizations and, you know, to meet new life forms, just by that interaction, you're going to affect the culture and how it develops.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to become part of that development of the culture. So the Prime Directive, as written, is impossible, or at least as we understand it to be written.
Yeah, I think the fact that it's very woolly in its definition. Somebody once said the Prime Directive was Kirk's reason for getting involved, but it was Picard's reason for not getting involved. And that's, the Prime Directive is very woolly in what exactly the Prime Directive is. Is it a non-interference directive? Or is it you can go and hide on this planet and pretend to be a native to watch the development, but you don't get involved? But by being there, like Paul says, you're involved. You're mm-hmm. there.
Yeah, it's just, now we're talking a matter of degree.
Yeah. The Prime Directive seems to be a very woolly law that gives the writers the opportunity to do whatever they want to do with it, depending on the story they want to tell.
Hmm. Well, it's a nice plot element that they can use for different dramatic effect throughout various numbers of shows. So, like you said, it means whatever the plot defines it to mean. So, and I think it's used to interesting effect here, you know, whether or not you need to follow it, you know, wholeheartedly, or whether or not you can sort of give it a nod and a wink and say Bob's your uncle and just let it go. Yeah.
And also, Sisko doesn't follow protocol himself. I mean, he actually says we will give first contact protocol a miss. And this is the first race they've encountered from the Alpha Quadrant.
And he meant to say Gamma Quadrant. Obviously, he was possessed by Sean's ineptitude.
So you can argue Sisko's disobeying his own rules already.
But Sisko's, at least on this station, Sisko is the boss.
Sisko's in command, yeah.
He's allowed to defy his own rules. It's do as I say, not do as I do. And I think to be the commander, I mean, this is not a tiny little, you know, this isn't a little boat on the sea with five crew members and they're adrift. This is a huge space station with families and people, and even just the Starfleet crew is huge. He cannot allow his command crew to just openly defy him, because now everybody is going to think, well, that's acceptable. Sisko isn't going to come down on you if you do that. And again, I think you're setting the wheels in motion for mayhem. You need to be the final authority figure on this particular station. And that means you can have an understanding with your crew as to what they can and can't do, but you need to develop that understanding before it goes any further.
So you think it was just too early for O'Brien to do this?
As written, yeah. I think had they changed it slightly, like I said, had that conversation take place before he did what he did, I think that would have been okay.
Okay.
And that, to me, that's the biggest flaw in the episode. Otherwise, you know, this is really entertaining.
Yeah, it was a really, really fun show. There's lots of phaser fighting. There's lots of battling. There's lots of good dialogue between O'Brien and Tosk. I love the costumes as well as the makeup in this. I think the costumes of the Tosk. No, I was just going to agree with the Tosk makeup's brilliant. And the army that comes and invaded. Mine? Yeah, a little bit enemy mine. And the hunters that come and attack the station, they've got brilliant costumes.
Not only do they have great costumes, but I love the special effects for their transporter. It's so distinctly different from the transporters that we see, not only the Cardassian and the Federation one, but it's very reminiscent of, I wanted to say, of like the original Tron with the sort of digitized effect. I thought that was a really neat effect there. But one of the things I liked about the phaser fight was specifically Odo, even when he had an opportunity to use a phaser, denied that he wanted to use it, or said that I don't use phasers. I like the fact that Odo is a hand-to-hand person. He feels that weapons are beneath him, and I like that part of his character, and we'll see that played out through the rest of these series. So I thought that was interesting, seeing that seated here.
Yeah, it also meant we got the really cool scene, though, of Kira having a phaser in each hand. Which I just thought was fun. It was really funny.
I will admit, you know, that they keep aiming for the little wrist bands or whatever, the wrist guards for the hunters, that those are little deflected plates on them. That seemed kind of weak, but yeah, that's just me nitpicking.
No, I just got the impression they were like Wonder Woman's bracelets.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, actually, that was the impression I got, that they were, that there was some sort of a defensive capability of it that kind of work to deflect the phaser.
Okay.
And they do show up and kick Starfleet's ass.
Pretty much.
Basically, don't they? This is the Jem'Hadar before the Jem'Hadar.
They reminded me almost a little bit in that first scene, a little bit of the Borg.
Yeah. And do we see these guys again?
I don't recall seeing them again, but if we do, we'll make mention of it when we do.
Because I think these would have been good people to bring back. But I'm also, you're watching these early episodes, and there's no indication that it is going to become as serialized as it will become, is there? Each episode is still very much of its own, stands on its own. O'Brien's disobedience here will not be mentioned again.
And that's part of why, you know, when we talked a couple of weeks back about how they could have transposed the order of episodes. Right now, we're still not in a point where we have any serious continuity going on that from one episode to the next. There's things that there'll be repercussions for, possibly, but there's nothing that is directly built upon.
Yeah, there's building of characters. There's interaction between people that's progressing, but there's not any specific storyline or story arc that's being set out, like we'll see later in season like 4 and 5 and so on. So yeah, and these pretty much can be watched in this. I think this first season could pretty much be watched in any order, and it really won't hinder your pleasure in watching it, I guess. So
yeah, I would tend to agree with you.
You could skip a couple of the lesser episodes that we've watched so far, and it wouldn't really matter.
Any of the all-important Morn sightings?
I did see Morn. He was walking across the scene behind someone. I can't remember specifically, but again, you know, I've got to assume it was into Quark's bar. But I know I did see him in this episode specifically, because I've been trying to watch out for him.
I have too, but I must have gotten distracted because I did not spot him in this episode. And that's it's always disappointing. An episode without Morn is like a morning without coffee.
Oh, coffee. I did like there was a little piece that I found interesting. When Tosk first encountered Odo, he gave him sort of a look as he possibly knew him, or at least knew of his race. And this is, I don't know if they're already seeing it this far into the, or this early into the series, but I think it's interesting if they are doing that these aliens from the Gamma Quadrant do know about Odo and his race and the race of the Founders. So if they were seeding at this early, that's kind of nice to see that. And if not, it's just a throwaway thing of Tosk looking at Odo. So
yeah, it was either recognition or it was confusion. And I would want to interpret it as recognition, because I think that makes the tapestry just a little richer.
Mm-hmm. mini
guns. Any other points on this one?
No, I thoroughly enjoyed this one. I mean, maybe it was watching it straight back at back to back with Babel, which I didn't think was great. I thought this one was a really solid episode. One of the interesting things about this is many, many people will tell you the first season's pretty cack. Yet of the six or five, if you're counting Emissary as one, that we've watched, we've thought that three of them have been pretty good. That's not a bad batting average for a first season show.
No, I'll agree. Compared to like the first season of Next Gen, this has been far superior. I mean, the episodes, you know, have had great character moments, and even the lesser episodes, like you said, of Babel have been at least enjoyable. So, yeah, there you go.
Yeah, I think the alien race was well defined in the short amount of time that we learned about them. I did like as well, nobody judges them for what they're doing. This is their way. You know, Cisco doesn't make any point of pointing out that what they're doing is barbaric. They do make mention to hunting, but they don't actually condemn the hunters or Tosk, because Tosk, for his part, seems to want to be engaged in the hunt.
Well, for Tosk, it seems to be a noble thing that he's essentially bred for this. His entire life, his entire existence is to be hunted by these people and to do everything in his capability to elude them. So the fact that he's going to, and that was one of the things about the character at the end, that he was going to be taken back captive and was going to be shamed because he was captured is just a thing that he can't really accept. It's a horrible thing. It would be better for him to evade them even more and possibly even be killed, because that's what Tosk is supposed to do. So it's an interesting concept. You know, these people who are being bred to be hunted, it sounds barbaric, but if this person being hunted is exceptionally capable of evading these hunters, doesn't that make that person doesn't that make it a kind of interesting concept? I don't know. I need more coffee.
I mean, I guess you could relate it to, you know, like where people, you know, where there's these man-made ponds and they seed them with fish for the sake of fishing in them. You know, it's a much smaller scale, but it's along the same lines if you think about it. Mm-hmm.
I mean, my only negative with this episode is the opening scene. It's not the Darbo girl. I don't want to call her a bit stupid for signing the contract without reading it, as Sean pointed out. It's a Ferengi contract. It's probably 600 single typed sheets of A4 back to back. So there's probably an awful lot there for her to read. But I kind of felt it was a step too far for Quark's character to have it in the contract that his Darbo girls have to sleep with him.
Well, I do kind of feel that this might be, and I think you talked about this or was kind of mentioned on your Palace episode where you're talking about Quantum Leap. Around this time, we were just getting over the Adita Hill, Clarence Thomas hearings over here, and the whole concept of sexual harassment and all of that was going on at the time. So I think this may have just been them sort of giving a sort of pre-credit sequence of dealing with a sort of hot topic issue at the beginning of the show. But I think that was just them putting that in there for, I don't know,
topical. It would have been fine if they'd done something with it, but we never see her again. Mm-hmm. And watching it 20 plus years later, you just sat there scratching your head at that bit.
And it, like I said, since it was, you know, Kelly Curtis, the sister of Jamie Lee Curtis, maybe it was just stunt casting of some sort.
Yeah, possibly. Maybe she's just a Star Trek fan. I don't know. In later seasons, that would have been Leeta, wouldn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and to me, that was almost a throwaway bit. It really was, you know, it was almost like a couple of weeks back having Bashir playing that concentration game with Dax. It really had nothing to do with the episode overall, and they could, if they cut it out, you wouldn't even notice. It wouldn't affect the episode in the slightest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it did kind of have that feel, definitely just the very throwaway thing. And I think in later episodes, yeah, that this could have been a plot point that could have been carried throughout the episode and they could have tackled this issue. But yeah, it does seem just kind of throwaway here at the beginning.
Well, according to the script, she was a minor subplot that they cut out, that to thank Sisko for what he did, she offered to spend the night with him, which I felt kind of undermines the the plot, but that's just me.
Yeah, I'm upset. I'm upset that Quark wants to grope me, but since you helped me out, I'll let you grope me. Yeah. Okay. Sure.
Oh, I suppose the difference is Sisko's not got it in his contract as commander of Deep Space Nine that he gets to nail the Dabo girls. Well, I suppose.
Yeah, I guess the difference is choice.
Yeah. Which I suppose could be the point of the subplot, had it actually made it to the episode. But my thinking from reading the Deep Space Nine companion where it talks about this, if they've gutted the subplot in that way, maybe they should have just cut that scene. Because it doesn't add anything to the story, does it?
No, not in the least. So what would we give this on our scale of 1 to 5 bars of gold-pressed latinum?
I think I'm going to go for a comfortable and safe 3. It's a good episode. It's not an outstanding episode. I enjoyed it much more than I enjoyed the last one, but it's not Deep Space Nine at its best. No, I'm going to go 3.5 because the makeup's great, and I'll give an extra half mark to anything that has Gerrit Graham in it.
Yeah, I'd probably go 3.5 as well. I do really like the special effects. Like I said, Scott McDonald did a great job of portraying a really alien character. Not only through the makeup effects and the costuming, but you know, just the way he carried himself and the sort of quirky way he looked around. I thought that was great. Them having O'Brien sort of as trying to be the breakout character still doesn't quite work, but this is early on in the first season. They don't know exactly what characters are going to be the breakout characters yet. So having an established character be the one that you're trying to hang the hat on of the show, it makes sense. But yeah, a 3.5 overall, I think, would work for me as well.
Yeah, I'm going to just be, you know, slightly contrarian and go with a nice even 3. Solid episode, enjoyable. I add my criticism of the writing as far as the chain of command went, but I don't think that's a fatal flaw to the episode. Better than average. Just a good episode, but there's not quite enough world building, not enough quite enough character moments to really bump it up higher than that for me.
All right. Well, do we want to move to a couple more emails? We've got a couple here. Do you want to? Let's see. Do you want to read one, Andy?
Yeah, sure. I'll read Jason Trenner's email, which has the headline "Not Spam." Just getting that out there so this baby doesn't get lost in the wormhole. Hey, guys.
Which I got to say, just for what it's worth, you know, as much as we've had fun with the not spam thing over the years on Back to the Bins, it does help because I know when I go into the Back to the Bins email box, there is spam there. And it's easy. You know, sometimes you have to look carefully to try and make sure what you're deleting isn't a letter from a listener. On the other hand, you don't want to open stuff that is spam. So titling it not spam is a plus.
Especially seeing as Jason opens with, "I thought I sent an email to the show for the first episode," which, did we not read that?
I don't.
Did that get lost in a wormhole?
I don't recall.
See, because I'm pretty certain that I archived all the emails. So if we did, Jason, I apologize.
Oops. He's basically asking if we're going to mention Peter David's Deep Space Nine novel that was apparently written with only about 5 episodes of the show filmed. I doubt that Peter will have actually seen any of them, to be honest with you. If that novel came out when 5 episodes had aired, he probably won't have seen any episodes. Jason says the only thing not meshing completely with the entire run of the show was Molly's age, which even the show didn't seem entirely sure of at some point. Peter David's The Siege novel is the only Deep Space Nine novel I've ever read. I remember it being okay, but I don't remember anything particularly outstanding about it. Have you two ever read that one?
No, unfortunately. Unfortunately, I haven't read too many of the. One of the things I am horrible about with Star Wars and Star Trek is the expanded universe stuff, especially the novels. I've read woefully too few of the novels, so that's one of those things I definitely need to go pick up and read.
I've read a ton of Star Trek novels, but they all tend to fall in between the original 5-year mission or pre and post Star Trek the Motion Picture.
Hmm.
Yeah, I've read a fair number of Star Trek novels over the years, but I haven't been doing too much reading of that of late. And to be totally honest, I don't think I have the time to dedicate to read books for the sake of doing them on the episodes. So, you know, if Luke wants to do it, I know he's big on the Star Trek novels, and he'd certainly be welcome.
What may be interesting, if we ever get to the end of this, it may be interesting to do an episode where we look at the Deep Space Nine continuation novels.
Ooh.
I mean, we probably wouldn't be able to get it out as consistently as we get this out, because watching is much easier than reading. But I think that may be an interesting way to wrap the show up.
Oh, that'd be good. When I'm like 57 years old, that'd be good to be doing.
We may be retired by then, so we'd have the time.
Oh, yeah.
And, well, the one thing, you know, we have discussed between the three of us that I'll just mention is the plan is, and hopefully we'll live up to the plan, is there is not an extensive number of comics that were released, but there is a Deep Space Nine series. I think it was Malibu/Marvel. And I think there's like 20 issues, somewhere around there, 20, 25 maybe.
Something like that.
And what I hope to do is to actually look and see what the dates that they were released on the newsstand and try and correspond reviews of those comics with the episodes that were airing approximately at the time that those issues came out. So okay. We will add that to the show, if we can, when the time is appropriate. I think it's in the second season that they started printing those.
Okay.
But I'm not sure. I have to look.
Jason continues that he loves the show. Thank you very much. We appreciate that. And he looks forward to each episode. Well, we enjoy that as well. I enjoy that. Look forward to each recording session. Also, did you guys know they wanted the science officer to be from a zero-G, or at least lighter gravity species originally? I think I did know that, but I completely forgot it. I think that would have been very expensive.
Mm-hmm. I did hear that. And I think they played on that a little bit in Enterprise with one of the alien races that they encountered.
And actually, I think there was an episode later on in Deep Space Nine where Bashir comes in contact with a alien from a lighter gravity system, where she has her crew quarters set up to the lighter gravity. And whenever she's out on the station, she has to wear some sort of bracer or something to keep her being able to walk upright.
Melora Hardin was the actress.
I think that's it. Yeah.
The episode. Yep. Jason also says that in the Where the Sea Meets the Sky novel, there is a communication officer on Pike's Enterprise that is one of the transparent skin species that's mentioned often in Deep Space Nine. I've not read that novel, but I do like Christopher Pike stuff, so I may check that one out. Jason concludes with, "Yeah, I don't really have much to say about this episode." Not much that you guys hadn't already said. Well, we appreciate you emailing in anyway, and we apologize if your first email got lost. Sorry about that, Jason.
Yeah, if you want to send it in again, we'd be happy to read it on the air. Okay, do you want me to get the one from Gene, or do you want to do that, Paul?
I'll leave that to your choice.
Okay. What would you have? I'll go ahead and do this one. We've got a final email here from Gene Hendricks, who's doing the Hammer Strikes podcast over at Two True Freaks. Go check that out, as well as Legend of the Superheroes and the brand new Anime Freaks podcast with Dr. Bill. So if you're not getting enough Dr. Bill on Listen to the Prophets, you can check it out on Anime Freaks as well. He writes in, Andy, Paul, and Sean. So you get second billing this time, Paul. Good.
I'm moving up, baby.
The title of the email was Garrick! Which I think is the way you should always say Garrick's name. He says, this was a great episode.
I think it should. Sean.
No,
I think it should always be plain simple.
Just plain simple Garrick. He said, it seems like all you said, that the writers were finally figuring out some of the characters. This was a great showcase for Kira, Sisko, Bashir, and even Odo. Kira coming to grips with her past and explaining that the future is what concerns her now was some great stuff. Actually, now that I think about it, it was more of Kira fighting for Bajor and Tantalos fighting against the Cardassians. It was nuanced as the best drama is. This episode probably filled in more of Kira's character than anything up to now. I'll have to agree with that. This was, you know, the past prologue episode was definitely one of the better episodes we've had, and specifically because it was a great showpiece for Kira and a great showpiece for Garrick as well. But I just love Garrick. Gene continues, says, but it was Garrick who stole the show. Oh, absolutely. Every phrase being taken two ways, his incredible smoothness in dealing with everyone, and his manipulation of Bashir just made me smile. In fact, if memory serves, I believe Garrick steals the show in every episode he's in.
Hear, hear.
Yes, I completely agree with that. As for Andy's issue with Klingon cleavage, and he spells that with a K, I must point out that both women are also wearing skirts, which would also hamper them in battle. I look at their costumes, and he says, yes, they're quote-unquote costumes, and I feel as if it is as feminine as Klingon gets. They are a warrior version of a sundress. Okay, at least that's my rationalization. So do you think that that's that if Lursa and Bator were actually going out to fight and kill someone, they would be in something that didn't have a boob window? And this is just, you know, frilly clothing or, you know, comfortable clothing that they wear?
No.
Okay.
the only rationalization I can come up with for it, and I don't buy this, so don't think I'm actually saying it, or that I mean it, rather, but if somehow they thought that it would present a distraction to somebody that they were going to combat, if either... I think it's probably a stretch to say somebody's eyes would be drawn towards that in a battle, because I don't think that would happen. But maybe to have an opponent underestimate them because of that. And I don't really buy that. If somebody presented that to me as an argument, I would say no, not in that future time, because I don't think that, you know, women, men would be looked at that way. You know, women as opposed to men. So no, I'm not buying it, but that's the argument I can come up with, and it's the only thing that's even close to rational.
No, I'm with Paul. I don't buy it at all. I think that it's there purely for titillating the audience, which I don't have a problem with in shows like Baywatch, because that's what the show is. You watch Baywatch, you know exactly what you're going to get. To complain that there are scantily clad men and women in Baywatch is stupid. But I hold Star Trek to a higher standard.
Okay.
I got to agree with you.
Okay, well, you know, I'll just say that, you know, I like boobs, so...
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying.
No, that's universal for us, but that's...
Yeah. I'm not saying I don't like boobs. I love boobs, but I think from a character standpoint, it does a disservice to Lursa and Beator. I don't have any problem with the scenes where Dax and Kira are going swimming in the holosuite and are wearing bikinis. That's perfectly acceptable were... for them to go doing what it is they're doing. Again, I grant you that it's titillation for the audience, because Terry Farrell and Nana Visitor are very attractive women. But when they're on duty, would they wear that? No, they wouldn't.
Okay. I will completely concede your point. That is very valid. If they are out doing business, they should not be dressed in a way that would hinder them in any way in case they got into an altercation or what. No, go ahead.
Yeah, my last point on this, really, because it is just a bit of a gag. I know Gene's just having a bit of fun with us. But the bottom line is the Klingons do a lot of fighting with knives. To have a huge gaping hole in your chest plate, right where an enemy could drive a knife into your chest, just seems remarkably stupid to me. Taking out of the equation that it's a nice bit of cleavage, it's not practical.
True. Ah, boob gate. This is what we're coming to on Listen to the Prophets. Wow. But yeah, does that wrap us up this time out? Do we have anything else that we want to talk about?
You've drained my mind.
par for the course. Andy, hit us up with a next time.
Next time on an all-new episode of Listen to the Prophets, the Q omnipotent being shows up upon Deep Space Nine. Will he be welcomed with open arms by Commander Sisko? What do you think?
I'm not Picard. Well, thanks everyone for listening. We'll catch you next time.
So long.
Bye-bye.
Visit our website at twotruefreaks.com. Two True Freaks is always spelled TWOTRUEFREAKS.
You can email Two True Freaks directly at twotruefreaks@gmail.com.
Two True Freaks and all of its excellent affiliates are available on iTunes, and you can choose to subscribe to either the entire network if you wish, or pick whichever individual shows you want to follow. We have so many shows to choose from, there's just bound to be one that appeals to your particular fandom. Just search Two True Freaks with an exclamation mark at the end, space, and the number 2.
You can find Two True Freaks on Facebook. Just search for Two True Freaks.
Dumbass.
If you ever leave your house and you actually have friends, why don't you tell them about Two True Freaks?
If you've enjoyed our show, please, won't you take a moment to rate us on iTunes? That helps others find the show, too.
Thanks for listening.
And join us every Monday for new episodes of
Two True Freaks.
Feel so much more awake than last week's episode.
So how was everyone's 2 weeks? Yeah, that was fun. I did things.
Oh! I did something exciting. Can I tell you? Can I?
Go ahead.
Down, boy. Down.
I've got an article being published.
Give him a
back
treat.
Issue.
What'd you
really?
Do? Say it again.
Yeah, I get paid and everything. I had to sign a contract.
Oh wow! What'd you write on?
I got in touch with them after they did an entire issue devoted to Marvel in the UK, and I got in touch with Michael Urie and said, "You do realize you've missed a Spider-Man comic strip that has only ever been published here?" And I sent him a link to the podcast that we did about it, and he got back in touch with me and said, "Do you want to turn that into an article for us?"
Oh nice!
So I said, "Of course!" So I submitted it to him and. Last week he sent me the contract. It will be in the August 2015 issue.
Are you eating an apple?
I am, but I will mute myself when we're actually recording.
I feel like Blazing Saddles. What's that in your mouth? Gum?
Is that
you didn't bring enough for everybody?
There's nothing I hate more than eating on a podcast. Are you still there?
Sounds like we lost Sean.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I muted.
Oh, I thought for a second. I thought for you collapsed for a second the way it sounded. It was like one of my diabetes discussions with Dr. Bill.
I think Bill and I are on the same diabetes medicine. It's basically the medicine which just basically tells you to stop eating donuts, fatty, which is, I think, you know, it's just a placebo pill, but it's, you know, supposed to make you get off the donuts, essentially.
I have thought I will write a diet book one day, and the first page will say, eat less, and the second page will say, move more, and the third page will say, the end.
Yep, that's essentially the way it works, you know. Stop eating so much food, get off grass, and there you go.